Hello, and welcome to the Robert A. Heinlein Book Club. And in this episode, I'll talk about the second half of Tunnel in the Sky, which I believe was 1956. I'm sorry, 1955. It's number 10 of the 12 Heinlein juveniles that he wrote. So I was a little disappointed with the first half of this book. Partially, maybe I was just distracted by the Malthusianism of it, which I always don't like. It's a thing. It's an issue I have with a lot of science fiction from this post-World War II era. And actually, it's still there in a lot of the science fiction writing. But you know, it's something I guess I got to get over if I want to read this stuff. But I was also, it just kind of read like an adventure tale and kind of an adventure tale that I've seen before. Like a young man, you know, out in the woods by himself trying to survive, that kind of thing. But in the halfway point of the book, Rod and Jack, who sort of meet up, they meet others. They meet others. There was like four schools that sent people to the through this tunnel in the sky, through this warp gate to this other planet. It's determined conclusively that they aren't on another planet and they're just lost. They're lost, but the recall never happened. So there was some malfunction. They weren't able to leave. So for all they know, they're going to be here forever. And they need to build up a new civilization. And that's the challenge in front of them. So they start to meet up with the different groups of that sent students on this test, this test mission of survival, which was supposed to just be a few days. And then they decide, basically, we need to start forming a civilization, a society. And the person who gets elected mayor is this guy, Grant Cowper. And he becomes a bit of an antagonist for much of the middle part of the novel. And I think that's kind of fun what's done with this. That some of the best stuff in this novel, and I do think the second half of this novel is much better than the first half because it is about young people building a civilization. In fact, it's almost like the opposite of Lord of the Flies, where you have kids build a type of civilization of types, and then it kind of goes off the rails. Here you have a very conflicted origin of these young people creating a civilization. It's tough. It's rough going. There's a lot of tension and conflict and different egos and differences, but they manage to come together, right? It's a much more positive narrative of human nature and ability to cooperate. And, you know, if you think of kind of the stuff I've said long, you know, for a long time in this podcast, all the way back to the Philip Dick stuff is, you know, I have an issue with just like Malthusianism with the way apocalyptic literature tends to paint society as like as something that's only can exist if there's a kind of complexity, if there's order, if there's sort of a top-down imperial structure, then you can have civilization and peace and order. But if you break that down kind of from the bottom up, people aren't really able to create lasting orders. They can only create war and conflict, right? Maybe five people in a gang, in a group, living in a prison, like in The Walking Dead, can sort of create a civilization. But anytime you have more than, you know, a few dozen, you're going to have authoritarianism and war and all these other problems that humanity is the problem, right? Now, of course, that was drives a lot of post-apocalyptic literature because the event itself is not that interesting. Zombies are only interesting for a little while. Nuclear war, once it's over, it's over, right? That can't be the tension. So you need to create new tension, and that is in the conflict among the human characters. And Heinlein does that to a degree, but it's all overcome. I mean, it's not like that becomes the story. It becomes just another challenge they face, and they do successfully overcome it and create a fairly sustainable civilization. The only reason it ends is because they finally, the gates reopened, and they get a chance to go back. And most people, although many people felt an investment in this world they built and this village they built and the community they're building and how they achieve something, a lot of them just choose to go back to their families. You know, it's been like 2 years that they've been apart. Now, Rod, our main character, he wants to stay, but he's left basically alone. So he also goes back. But it's foreshadowed that he at some point in the near future will be one of these explorers that goes through gates to other planets and does this again. Like, he'll take this experience and use that to be a leader of an expedition that's going to build a new civilization. And maybe he'll come back to this one, right? It's heavily implied that they can just come back to this planet and finish the job of building a civilization as such. So the idea, the main theme here of building an advanced civilization, one of the last chapters of the book is literally just called Civilization, with the basic tools that they brought just on a survival mission. So they have knives. They just have a couple books, so they don't have paper. Right, they have one journal, one diary, and then they got like the margins of a Bible and the margins of a Quran. That's all they got for paper. So they can't really use paper to create like legal codes. So they don't really want, at the same time, they're not really equipped for an oral tradition culture, because that's not the kind of world they come from. So they struggle with that. They struggle with forming family units. And I had kind of hoped more from Heinlein, because you know, he kind of just pairs them off and they embrace kind of a monogamy rather. I mean, they do have a swayed gender ratio here. There's more boys than girls. So you'd think maybe they could have managed something more like the line marriage. But maybe for a juvenile, Heinlein didn't want to get into any kind of more radical sexual politics. But they just sort of pair off. And it seems a major plot point that these people are pairing off and getting married and living off in their little nuclear family homes. And I think that shows a limit of either Heinlein's imagination, which actually I don't think is there, because he shows us imagination about sexual politics in other works, but maybe in a lack of imagination among the characters, in that because they're young, and they fall in love, and you know how young people are in love. They're insane at that point. It's older people like me who have a more mature attitude towards monogamy and relationships and things. I think that's my perception of the world. But it's, so that's something, I'm not going to say too much more about it, except they do sort of pair off. This is the first juvenile, as far as I can tell, that has like clear sex, like written to the page. Like, you know, there's babies and there's marriages and things. There's sexual politics in a way in some of the other works, like we talked about the Willis and Lummix being like misgendered by the humans because they're aliens and like alien species with much different gender. I think it's Willis's species, the Martians, they sort of change their gender as they get older. And Lummix, of course, is one of six genders, but it's more female than male, even though Lummix was assumed to be male by the humans. So there's that stuff, but actual, like, sex isn't, you know, and I don't think it's avoidable. You have a bunch of young people, and some are, like, college, and some are high school, living together for 3 years. So it's managed through kind of a system of marriage. And that's fine, I guess. I just kind of, you know, would have liked a little bit more creativity with the social arrangements that would emerge, especially when there's not enough girls to go around, really, for an absolute pairing up of everyone. Okay, to this plot itself, it's basically building civilization, but there is some tensions here. Like I said, in the beginning, middle part of the book, there's a very fascinating tension between Cowper and some of the younger people, because Cowper, when he becomes mayor, or such, I think it's maybe the captain or mayor, I forget the title. The title might change. Maybe, I think it's mayor. He's older and he has some experience in political science. He's more of he's like a college student, and he puts into committees, he creates all these committees, maybe too many committees, and he puts into power in the committees basically his friends. And they're all the older boys. So there's a conflict between the younger boys and the younger boys and girls and the older ones and the younger ones. There's a tension there. And Cowper kind of is justified in what he's doing, because he's got a little bit too much book learning about how government works. And he's a little less intuitive. And so he kind of runs things through all these executive committees. And there's all sorts of them. And they're all headed by, like, the older kids. And there's a logic behind Cowper's approach here, but he's politically quite naive because he quickly offends a lot of the other people. Remember, Rod runs for mayor, kind of unwillingly, but, you know, he didn't really want it, but he runs anyways, and he doesn't get enough votes. Cowper gets the most votes. And he sort of is running it sort of like a dictatorship, and the people ask questions like, well, when are we going to have a new election? When are we going to have a constitution? When are we going to have all these things that have been promised to us? And then they're like, well, we have a committee working on the constitution. We have a committee working on this or that. And there was kind of almost a revolt by some of the younger kids, like the high school kids, to put Rod in place, who they respect him. He's kind of the leader of the younger kids faction. And he actually literally turns it down. And this is like kind of brilliant politics on his part, because if he would have sided with the rebellion, he would have just been ostracized and out of politics. But by not embracing the coup attempt, which he knew would fail, he sort of puts himself in a position of being a necessary ally of Cowper. And then Cowper has to come to him and say, okay, I want to put you in charge of essentially like our police force. I want to share power more with the younger kids. And he changes his approach to be a little bit more responsive to the people. And he starts to break down some of the committees, and he actually responds to the practical realities of governing a society like this. And he starts to go to Rod for advice a lot more. Now, one thing that Rod complains about is another point of tension here is where they're settled. And this is resolved really interestingly. Is that Rod thinks this is a dangerous place. There's all these indigenous species that they're hunting and stuff, and they were warned about a species, which is just a generic name for, like, every planet has something that's dangerous, so it's just something they use to scare the kids. But, you know, there are dangers here. And their location is kind of exposed. And so Rod thinks they need to move to a less exposed location, and they need to find where to go. And so eventually, after things sort of settle, Rod and someone else, Roy and Rod, I think it is, two of the boys, go on an expedition, a mission, to scout another location. And remember, I complain about these juveniles. A lot of them have, like, people getting lost and injured and need to be saved. That happens again here, but it's so minor. It's such a Passover event. It's not like the central climax of the book. I actually forgive him for this, but yeah, one of them gets injured. I think it's Rod gets injured, broken leg. But they find, like, a cave network. Like, it's almost like the Anasazi people, that, you know, they lived in, like, caves against the rock face. And he finds this to be a very defensible location. He's like, this is where we can move and settle and defend ourselves from the dangers. But the problem with that, and it's not really revealed till they come back, is, you know, people have been, they've been building homes. They are settled in that place. They have families in the locations. Like, the married couples were built homes. They built homes for the married couples. So people, they didn't want to, if they were to move, they'd give up all that work they'd done. Even though it's dangerous, people don't want to move unless they have to. And Rod's like, no, we need to move. But there's some tension about whether they'll come back. And we have this other important character. And that's Carolyn. Carolyn is, she also ran for mayor, and she lost, and she ends up being, like, the scribe, because she's the one with the diary, so and she knows shorthand, so she becomes the historian, sort of the community, the one keeping records of meetings and things like that. But she becomes really close to Rod. And so she's the point of view character we have, while Rod doesn't come back when he's supposed to, and she fears he's dead, and turns out he's just one of them was just injured and had a broken leg and had to wait out the healing before they could come back. And they come back and they have a nice big party, and they come back sort of as heroes, but Rod says, we need to move to this place. And then he's basically struck down by the mayor, by Cowper, saying, like, we're not leaving. We invested too much time in here, and it may not be perfect, but we can't do that. That lasts for a while. And then how does this get resolved is really fascinating, is that they get attacked by this indigenous species who turn out to be more sentient, more intelligent than they thought. And again, this is a trope we've seen before in Heinlein's juveniles. I guess with Lummix was more intelligent than they thought. The learning that there are intelligent species on planets is something that we've seen in like Space Cadet. We saw it in Red Planet, of course. Farmer in the Sky had it. Between Planets, well, Between Planets, they knew they were sentient. But you know, I think we've seen this before, where there's this creature that looks like just a dumb animal that turns out to be sentient, and then they actually move on the humans and destroy their or break in and kill a bunch of them and kill the mayor. And after this destruction, after this violence against them, they fight them off, but they're kind of in a vulnerable situation. Now's the perfect time for Rod to say, okay, now here's the proof. We have to go into the caves. But after being elected mayor, he changes his mind on this. And he says, like, we have bled for this land, and we're not going to let any like other species prove to be better than humans and chase us off. So we're sticking with this land. And it's kind of a really cinematic, dramatic moment. This is at the end of chapter 13. So he goes through and he says, like, I don't know your constitution. I just got back from this. But I'm going to be a dictator unless you vote a no confidence. He says, that's the deal. And they're like, okay, that conforms with our constitution. We have the right to remove you, but you can do what you want. And they sort of want, they almost welcome a dictator at this point because of the trouble they're in. They say, what you described as a parliamentary vote of confidence, that's the backbone of our constitution. We did it that way to keep it simple and still democratic. It was Grant's notion. I'm glad, Rod said soberly. I hate to think that I had torn up Grant's law after he worked so hard on them. I'll study them, I promise, first chance I get. But about moving to the caves, we'll have a vote of confidence right now. Goldstein smiled. I can tell you how it will come out. We're convinced. So right away, everyone's like, we're going to follow you to the caves. But he says this. Rod slapped the ground. You don't understand. If you want to move, move, but get someone else to lead you. Roy can do it, or Cliff, or Bill. But if you leave it to me, no dirty little beast, all teeth and no brain, are going to drive us out. We're men, and men don't have to be driven out, not by the likes of those. Grant paid for this land, and I will stay here and keep it for him, end quote. So he turns around on this issue because of Grant's sacrifice and this feeling of insult almost at like humanity's pride. It's almost racist here, right? Because these are other clearly sentient species who are able to organize an attack on them. But he sees them as less than humans. And that is something, of course, we see in Starship Troopers. And it's a criticism that's been leveled at Heinlein, is he tends to see humanity as this kind of almost vanguard species. Now, I think that's a little reductive because you have other works in which humanity is not equal to the aliens. You have, like, for instance, you also have something like the Star Beast. Where even there, you have a little bit of, like, even though these guys are more advanced than us, we're going to fight for our rights and our quality, right? But it wasn't domination in the Star Beast. And I don't think it is in something like Between Planets, where the Venerians are clearly like more advanced and more complex civilizations than the humans in a lot of ways. So I think it's a mixed bag. But that trope is part of Heinlein's work. And we see it here, is this kind of human-centric kind of arrogance coming out. But as a character point of view, I think it's fascinating. I think setting aside that and just looking at it, not as Heinlein saying this, but as Rod, this character who just suffered this loss and thrust in the position of authority, saying, no, we're going to stick, we're going to build something here because people like died for it. It's just a good character moment, I think, for Rod, who, like I've complained before, a lot of these juvenile heroes are a little forgettable, and Rod's less so than most of them. Rod's probably one of the stronger of these characters in that he has an arc. I think the first half, he is kind of just another very competent young man, but the arc he has in the second half, I think, is pretty substantial, and his being thrust into leadership, it's really, really well done. I enjoyed this quite a lot. So then we get to chapter 14. We're getting towards the end of the book, which is just called Civilization. And there's a time gap. I don't quite know how long, because they're there for 2 years. So it's a significant bunch of time. And they're setting the foundations for a long-term, multi-generational civilization. And we see this with, like, the agriculture, because they can't eat the local seeds, the local grasses. They have to turn them into, like, wheat and grain, just like humans on Earth had to do over many, many generations. Maybe they can do it a little faster because they understand genetics. But it's something that's going to take a long time to do. So no one who's alive now, and even the kids, are going to be able to eat bread, but their grandkids maybe will be able to eat bread. That's what is established. But other things, like on tech, people, there's an urgency to establish that technology and get it down on paper and to create the tech, because it's in the kids' heads, so it's more plausible. Now, the question of, they don't have steel yet because they don't have coal supplies. They have charcoal that they can make, which is only good for making is it cast iron? No, I think it's like a just pure iron, right? Not combined with carbon. So it's not very hard, which isn't great for weapons and things. It's good for some defense and some tools, but not very effective. Pure iron is rather soft. You need it alloyed with things for it to work. But the kids know how to do it. They have, at least some of them have that knowledge, but they don't have the materials yet. But they're going to try to get them. And then this is kind of the same with paper. There's like this effort to, like, we need to start establishing paper. They're making progress. And just as they're making this progress, it's almost tragic, actually, the arrival of the adults. Well, most of these kids are adults by the time the novel ends, right? But the arrival of the people from Earth, finally reopening the gate and checking in on them. And then the whole thing breaks apart very quickly, where most of the members of this community will miss it. They feel sorrow over this, but they also can't say no to their family. They need to go home. And Rod is feels this loss at this, but he eventually goes back too. And the last couple chapters deal with that. Now, there's some weird stuff, like his teacher marries his sister while he was gone. Kind of a May, October. Is that what it's called? May, October, April, October, spring, winter marriage. But I don't know. I don't know why that's in there. Maybe just to make a connection between Rod and his Matt's and the teacher and his sister Helen. I don't know. But at the end, we learn that he's going to continue this. Maybe he'll go back to the same planet and finish the job of building civilization there, or maybe he'll go somewhere else, but he now is able to do that. So he's developed the leadership skills to achieve this dream of his, this goal of his. So overall, a really, really strong ending to this novel. It really, I think, redeems it. Very, very well done, and not what I fully expected. I had a lot of guessing here of where it would end up. Like, they would never go back to Earth. Maybe, like, I was speculating at a time that they went through time. That doesn't seem to be the case. I was speculating about, like, the relationships. And, yeah, it's like he doesn't end up with Jack. He doesn't end up with Jacqueline. You know, it's Carolyn he seems to develop a closer relationship with at the end. Jack was just the first girl he met, and he mistook her for a boy. But the... you know, a lot of things I did not expect happened. And it became a much more interesting novel once we started getting into the politics of it all. And even our older, more mature characters who come in kind of arrogantly have their moments where they learn that they overstepped and that they need to be more political and they need to negotiate and share power a little bit more. And that how Cowper becomes a good mayor, I think, is maybe an understated theme of the book. He dies, opening the door for Rod's rise, but when he dies, he's kind of a good mayor. He's come to terms with the balancing act he needs to achieve what they're trying to do. He just was too bureaucratic, maybe too ambitious, too many meetings, right? There's a weekly, at the start of it, there's like daily meetings, and by the end there's just weekly meetings or monthly meetings. So he kind of has to be humbled by this. And I think that's great too. I'm really, really nice. I'm just having so much fun with these juveniles, and I'm always surprised by them. I always think, oh God, this one's going to be a slog, because I am looking forward to getting into the adult novels. I'm looking forward to Stranger in a Strange Land, and even like Double Star, which is coming up. The adult novels, I'm really excited to get into them, and I'm excited to get into the '60s and the middle Heinlein, and to get to the stuff I've never read before. Because, you know, I know not that, I mean, I've read Stranger in a Strange Land and Moon is a Harsh Mistress, but, and Double Star. Those are and Door into Summer. So those four I have read. Oh, Owl Fear No Evil. So there's five of them. So some I have read before, but there's a lot of stuff like Time Enough for Love and The Cat That Walks Through Walls and Friday and Job that there's like, I'm excited to get to that. But at the same time, I don't feel the like urgency in the same way because I am enjoying these. I didn't think I would as much as I did. And so we got three more. We got Time for Stars, Time for the Stars. We have Citizens of the Galaxy, which I know that one's about slavery. And then we have Spacesuit Will Travel or whatever, that last one. And that's three of them, and I expect at least two of them to blow me away the way these last few have. If all three blow me away, that's even better. But we'll see. I'm confident that at least a couple of these three will be great. So in the next episode, we're going to jump straight to 1956, and we have two novels in 1956 to talk about: Time for the Stars, and then we'll do an adult novel, which we'll probably just do one episode on it because it's super short, and that would be Double Star. And I don't think there's any stories until 1956 or 1958 with Tenderfoot in Space. Well, it says it was written in 1956, serialized 1958 in Boy's Life. It was originally called Tenderfoot in Venus, written in 56, and then published in The Boy's Life in three issues. So I don't think I have the audiobook for this one, but I might have to like print it out from, it's in Requiem, so, which I think I have a copy of that, at least as a PDF. But anyways, maybe I'll wait till 58 to do it when it was serialized. If I want just to delay it a little bit. I kind of want to, I don't want to slow down reading these juveniles because they're lots of fun. So maybe after have Spacesuit Will Travel, we'll look at Tenderfoot in Space. Maybe kind of wrapping up our juvenile mindset at that point, if I can find it. So, yeah, that's it for now. So the next three episodes, we'll look at two novels, Time for the Stars and Double Star. So anyways, thanks for listening. Let me know what you think of Tunnel in the Sky. If there's anything I missed or anything perspective that you have that I'd not share, let me know what that is. But see you next time. Thanks for listening.